Good afternoon, Council. Ready to proceed?
Afternoon, Chief Justice Steele, Justice Holland, Justice Risley. May it please the Court, my name is David Wilkes. I'm with the firm of Reed Smith in Wilmington. I represent Christopher Bryant, the creditor trustee for Ingersoll International Incorporated. With Your Honor's indulgence, I've requested to reserve 5 minutes of my time.
Sure.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, first I would like to express our gratitude to the Court for expediting this matter. The Court was very gracious in moving this case along. I know the motion to dismiss was filed in this case less than 6 months ago, and here we are before Your Honors. We appreciate that very much. We come to Dover today to ask the Court to review and to reverse a one-of-a-kind case in Delaware history. Never before has a Delaware trial court dismissed a case for want of prosecution following a mere 7 months of inactivity on a docket. The Court of Chancery's decision runs contrary to longstanding case law in this court, longstanding line of cases in the Court of Chancery, and really a line of cases and a line of jurisprudence upon which litigants have come to rely, and properly so. This well-reasoned line of decisions was disregarded by the Chancery Court, and in fact, the Court of Chancery very openly departed from the policies and the rules that have been part of the Delaware jurisprudence for many, many years. We ask that the Court reverse that decision. We submit that the Court of Chancery erred as a matter of law, applied its own rule of law rather than that which has been established by this Court. And in any event, its decision constituted a breach of, or an abuse of its discretion. By asking for reversal, we in no way ask the Court to make new law or do anything radical or anything different than it's been doing for I think 43 years since the Ayers decision. On the contrary, to affirm the Court of Chancery's decision would actually require this Court to make new law, to divorce itself from those longstanding principles that this Court has embraced for many, many years. And really, there's no extenuating circumstances. There's nothing so unusual about the circumstances of this case which would suggest that longstanding precedent should be upset. So rather than making new law, the appellant simply comes before the Court today respectfully requesting a reversal of the Court of Chancery's decision in order to maintain the state of Delaware law as it has existed for many years. Now, I know the Court is well familiar with the procedural background of this case, and I would like to hit the high points. I won't belabor the procedural history. Suffice to say, in December of 2000, three shareholders, members of the same family, three sisters, filed a shareholder derivative case against the board of directors of Ingersoll International. The suit sought to undo or to put a stop to, enjoin, a sale of assets of Ingersoll International. It was a two-step transaction that they sought to enjoin. The Court of Chancery put the case on an expedited schedule. The case went at a fever pitch for, I think, 3 weeks of expedited discovery over the holiday season of 2000-2001. And right after New Year's of 2001, the Court of Chancery convened a preliminary injunction hearing, at which time it was, to me, it was rather unusual. Oftentimes, preliminary injunction motions are denied on the basis of the fact that the plaintiff is unable to establish a substantial likelihood of success on the merits. That's not what happened here. Since the transaction was a two-stage transaction, the hearing was held between the two closings. The Court actually found there is a substantial likelihood of success on the merits in the case. The case has merit. However, the Court determined that it would do more violence to the company by enjoining the second half of the transaction and trying to undo perhaps the first half than it would just to let it go forward and let the plaintiff proceed with the damages claim. So that's
the position is that there was only 7 months of inactivity. Is the Vice Chancellor precluded at looking at what happened before that or the cumulative effect of the periods of inactivity?
Well, I think the answer to that is in a few parts. Number one, we have a new plaintiff, and the new plaintiff is the creditor trustee. As the Court knows, the case went along for a couple of years, just over 2 years. It fits and starts. There were plaintiff's counsel were placed twice, and there were some periods of inactivity and rather frustrating pace of the litigation. What's crucially important, I think, Your Honor, and go directly to your to your question, the attorneys that the original plaintiffs hired in February of 2003 took very decisive action very quickly. They answered long overdue discovery with substantive responses, not a pile of objections. They propounded discovery. They took steps to put the case on a new trial track. Under the Ayers decision of this court, really that activity really served to more or less cure the delays that had preceded that activity. The Ayers court held that a case will not be dismissed for want of prosecution, where a plaintiff, even if a plaintiff had previously been grossly negligent, takes steps, affirmative steps, to move the case forward and to act diligently. So we would submit, Your Honor, that at that point, really the delays, and it's two years of delays at the most at that point, had really been cured. Really what happened after that was 2.5 years occasioned by the nominal defendant's bankruptcy. The original plaintiffs lost the authority to pursue the case. Under the bankruptcy statute, it was the original plaintiffs were precluded from proceeding with this case. The case then became the property of the bankrupt estate. The original plaintiffs urged the bankrupt estate, please proceed with this litigation. It's a meritorious case. Please do so. And the debtor declined to do so, refused to do so. Under those circumstances, then, the original plaintiffs were powerless to move the case forward. So I think it would be inappropriate for the Court of Chancery at that point to attribute any of that two and a half year delay spent in the bankruptcy proceedings in a failure to prosecute context and to place that burden upon then the creditor trustee. Because in the course of the bankruptcy proceedings, then the plan of liquidation and a settlement agreement among a great number of parties, the creditor trustee was then, his office was created along with a trust for the benefit of all the creditor constituencies of Ingersoll International. And this litigation became an asset owned by the creditor trust to be prosecuted by the creditor trustee if the creditor trustee so chose that in his fiduciary obligation to the trust, it was a sound investment, really, for the trust to invest in this litigation and to proceed with its prosecution. I'm giving Your Honor a very long answer to a seemingly very simple question, but with that context, Your Honor, and with that procedural history, I think it was completely inappropriate for the Court of Chancery to look back and tag the creditor trustee with delays that, A, were 2.5 years of which were caused by something that was beyond anyone's control. It was occasioned by the bankruptcy and the operation of the bankruptcy statute. And 2 years of delay, potentially delay, caused potentially by the original plaintiffs, but which had been cured when the original plaintiffs made very clear they intended to proceed with the case. They became diligent. They diligently responded to discovery, sought to put the case on a track for a trial.
Didn't the Vice Chancellor find prejudice because of the age of critical witnesses?
It did, Your Honor. And
so how does that cure? How can that be cured, that prejudice?
It's cured in almost every case we have, I think, Your Honor, in the Court of Chancery. The Court of Chancery and this court are no strangers to cases involving elderly witnesses. I mean, we're talking about a board of directors, and sure, these are seasoned business people and so forth who get on in years. But there is no shortage of examples in this court and the Court of Chancery where the events in question predate a trial by many, many years. We've identified some of them in our papers. The Technicolor case was tried most recently 20 years after the transaction at issue. The Disney case, I think, the events were 10 years old. And there's the list goes on and on. What's important, I think, is to remember is the passage of time under Delaware's jurisprudence does not form the basis of the sort of prejudice that warrants dismissal of a case. Now, there are other means by which witnesses' forgetfulness or the loss of evidence may be dealt with at trial. At that point, it's the trial judges or the trier of fact to apportion whatever weight to evidence that it deems fit. And if witnesses are unable to recall events, well, there are means by which the court can then credit or discredit that testimony. But really, there's no there's no precedent in this court or in this state, really, for the notion that the passage of perhaps 6 years' time is enough to warrant dismissal of a lawsuit. The Lane case, with which the Chief Justice is familiar, was 12 years old at the time that the case made it to trial. The Emerald Partners case was 11 years old. There are many, many cases more than 10 years old, far, far older, twice as old as this case will have been should it go to trial. So really there's no precedent for the notion that, well, it's been 6 years, people have probably forgotten, let's dismiss the case. It's never been done in Delaware, and it's really contrary to all the principles of Delaware law.
What about if, let's assume the Vice Chancellor, I think he said he aggressively manages his cases, and he's made that choice to do that. Must he, notwithstanding making that choice, accept 12 years as the norm or 10 years as the norm? Doesn't he have the discretion to run a docket that is essentially much more current?
If that were possible, Your Honor, and realistic, I think that would be wonderful. I think, though, the realities of what the civil justice system and the criminal justice system, but more the civil justice system, are asked to do is unfortunately more rigorous than that. We ask juries all the time to try facts that are old and witnesses with perhaps faded memories. There's no justification, no precedent in this jurisdiction, though, for the notion that that warrants dismissal. There just is no such precedent in that regard. Really, in what the line of cases in the Court of Chancery and that have been upheld in this court, the alternative remedy to dismissal is to put the case on a schedule, a strict schedule, and enforce that schedule. That's the remedy that the Court of Chancery routinely follows in cases of this nature, and those cases are collected in a brief.
The rule matter. Authorizes dismissal, doesn't it?
It does indeed. 41B and 41E both provide for dismissal for want of prosecution. The way those rules, though, have been construed in this court and in the Superior Court and the Court of Chancery has not been to dismiss cases on the basis of 7 months of delay. And really, we talk about delay of 7 months. I would submit to Your Honors that this is not a delay of 7 months. There's not a period of inactivity of 7 months. There was plenty of activity. There was no activity on the court's docket, certainly granted. But in that seven-month period, the creditor trustee was hard at work discharging its fiduciary obligations to the trust and discharging his duties as an officer of the bankruptcy court. But more to Your Honor's point, where a motion is brought under Rule 41B, Chancery Rule 41B, which is the case here, what this court has held in Ayers and has reaffirmed later on in other cases is that you must look at Rule 41E. You must decide your 41B motion in the context or with consideration of 41E. 41E, of course, only allows for dismissal of a case after 1 year of inactivity. We don't have that here. We have it if you tack on 2.5 years of bankruptcy, which are not chargeable or taxable against the creditor trustee. And really, that 2.5 year period is also being tacked on in another sense. By holding that the prejudice to the defendants is so great because we have faded memories and we have aging witnesses and 6 years is just too long to wait. Well, what that necessarily does is burden the creditor trustee with a 2.5 year period of time spent in the bankruptcy court. So in other words, any time that there's a case in the Court of Chancery and that is delayed somehow by a bankruptcy, well, then necessarily the litigants have to start worrying that though they are powerless to move forward, they are being prejudiced and may lose their cause of action simply by the passage of time over which they have zero control. And that's what the Court of Chancery did here, Your Honor. And that, for that reason, we suggested it was an arbitrary and capricious decision. Because by finding that, listen, these people are old, they probably forgot. I don't know if they forgot, because it's not in the record. But I think they probably would have forgotten. And it's because, well, you have 2.5 years here, the case was on the shelf in the bankruptcy court. Your Honor, that is not the way that, the Rule 41B and Rule 41E has ever been construed before in this jurisdiction. Never before. This is a one-of-a-kind case. And for that reason, Your Honor, we think that we suggest that the Court of Chancery, by, first of all, not giving due consideration to Rule 41E in its 41B analysis, used the wrong legal standard. We also suggest, Your Honor, that the Court abused its discretion. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time. I would certainly favor continuing the discourse with Your Honor, Chief, or Justice Ridgely, but really, again, we're not asking the Court to make new law. We're asking simply that the Court not make new law. Simply apply the same legal principles. The overarching legal principle, the case should be decided on their merits. Remand the case to the Court of Chancery for a full trial on its merits, giving the parties adequate time to complete discovery in an expedited, diligent fashion, which the creditor trustee is certainly ready and willing and able to do. Try the case on its merits and follow the jurisprudence that this Court has adhered to for 43 years. Many thanks.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Mike Pittenger on behalf of appellees John Doerr and Dieter Feisel. Before I begin, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Bert Ashman, here at counsel table with me. I would also like to thank the Court, as did Mr. Wilkes, and express our appreciation for the Court's willingness to hear this matter on an expedited basis. This case does have has a very long and tortured history, as Your Honors can see from the briefs. It was filed back in December of 2000. There was expedited discovery, and the motion for a preliminary injunction was denied on the basis, in part, that the plaintiffs had already engaged in unreasonable delay in pursuing their claims. At the conclusion of oral argument, a whole day's worth of argument on that motion for a preliminary injunction, Vice Chancellor Strine urged the parties to get a schedule in place and to move the case forward expeditiously in view of the fact that there had already been delay. That didn't happen. There was 2.5 years more of inaction, delay, withdrawals of two different sets of counsel for the plaintiffs, one because the plaintiffs wanted to engage in conduct that, quite honestly, their counsel did not believe was ethical, found it appalling.
Was the time period of the bankruptcy stay counted against the plaintiff?
Your Honor, I believe what the Court of Chancery below did, it was took into account all of the delay of the prior plaintiffs and the fact that the bankruptcy had resulted in 2.5 years more of delay, and looked at it as a situation in which the trustee inherited a case that was what it was, had a lot of hair on it, and was 5 years old. The only reason it was not time barred was because it had been previously filed. The Court of Chancery looked at it and said, what did the trustee know when it inherited this case, and what kind of case did it inherit when it determined whether the further delay was reasonable? And what the trustee knew when it inherited the case was about all the pre-bankruptcy delay and inequitable conduct. It knew that the bankruptcy had caused 2.5 more years of delay. The trustee also knew, because the defendants made this very clear when they objected to the plan in the bankruptcy that tried to impermissibly release defenses that they had, including delay-based defenses, made a big deal in the bankruptcy about the fact that we were going to raise delay-based defenses if the action were to move forward. The trustee knew all of that. The trustee also knew that Vice Chancellor Strine had requested periodic status reports and knew that Vice Chancellor Strine had wanted this matter to move quickly, if not during the bankruptcy, then to move expeditiously once the bankruptcy was over. I believe in his rulings he said something along the lines that no one who was involved in that bankruptcy was under any lack of understanding that the Court of Chancery wanted this thing to move along. The Court looked at all of that and said, this is what the trustee knew. And yet the trustee decided to do absolutely nothing for 7 months from the time the plan became effective, 8 months from the time of the confirmation order, some point in there, and it's not clear from the record, the trustee was retained and began to get familiar with this case. Now, Mr. Wilkes stated that there was action during this time. I think he said just nothing on the docket. Well, in the Ayers case, this court made very clear that the diligence of plaintiff is relevant for purposes of Rule 41B, quote, only insofar as it results in action taken to prosecute the claims in the courts or action taken to settle the dispute by direct negotiations with defendants, end quote. That didn't happen. There was no status report filed, even though that was something that the Court of Chancery had required.
Well, are you saying nothing happened that fits the definition that, or the framework that you just outlined, or are you saying there was flat no activity? There can be preparation for trial activity, but no notice of deposition filed in the court or that kind of thing. What did go on?
That's,
if anything.
That's correct, Your Honor. What I meant was that nothing went on the docket or anything like that. There was no status report filed. There was not even a courtesy letter or courtesy communication to the court or to the defendant saying, we're investigating this, it's going to take us a few months, and we might or might not prosecute. That's notwithstanding the fact that we filed two status letters saying, we still haven't heard a word, don't know what's going on. Now, what did happen is that the trustee claims that very quickly he went out and hired the counsel who had represented the Gaylords, who were the plaintiffs in this action, in the bankruptcy, and then quickly went out and hired the same counsel who had represented the Gaylords in the Delaware litigation to conduct an investigation. And a report based on the affidavits filed in connection with the motion for re-argument was submitted in November of 2005. The trustee claims that there was diligent investigation going on for 7 months, but there's no dispute that we were never contacted, the court was never contacted, to say that this diligent investigation that allegedly exists was going on. I will submit, as the court below found, it doesn't take 7 months to investigate claims like this. The person hired to do the investigation was the same person that Mr. Wilkes is saying, once he was retained prior to the bankruptcy, diligently tried to move this action forward. They were very familiar with the action. It didn't take 7 months to do an investigation. I further submit that the lack of any communication to the court not only did not constitute prosecution within the meaning of Rule 41B, it was an affront to the court. It was disrespectful of the court below. There was a rule in place to submit status reports, and that just didn't happen. And so, in short, I believe that what the lower court did was look at all of the history that had preceded this, all of the delay caused by that, and evaluated what exactly did this trustee inherit, and was it reasonable to wait 7 more months with no communications? The court below, by the way, rejected what he called the myriad of excuses for the 7 months of delay. And that myriad of excuses was fleshed out in the motion for re-argument, where the plaintiffs submitted additional affidavits. They tactically decided not to submit any of that evidence with their answering brief, decided to... I don't think they were taking the motion seriously, quite honestly, at that stage, and they decided to put in their answering brief what they put in their answering brief and the affidavit they filed with that. And after they got a preview of what the court below was thinking, they crafted some affidavits to attempt to address that. The court below not only struck those affidavits, I think, properly on the motion for re-argument, but it actually considered what was in them. It's very clear from the record of the hearing on re-argument that the court rejected the myriad of excuses that was offered and explained why, under the circumstances, it was improper to take 7 months with all the delay that had come before to, quote, investigate this action. Mr. Wilkes states that the Court of Chancery openly disregarded a long line of Delaware law. That's not the case. I submit the court below carefully laid out the factors it should consider and considered each of those factors. There's no dispute here that the standard applicable to reviewing the lower court's determination to dismiss this is an abuse of discretion standard. The court below lived with this case for 5.5 years. It made its views very well known to all involved that it wanted to move the case forward quickly once bankruptcy was over and that the parties should do that. The court below carefully considered the long history, focused on the complete lack of any prosecution after the bankruptcy. It considered the excuses offered by the trustee and rejected those. It took into account the important policy favoring resolution of suits on the merits. There are several places in the transcript where it took into account that policy. I don't think it's credible to say that the court ignored the strong policy to decide suits on the merits.
Was there ever compliance with the Court of Chancery order to pay $5,000 in fees?
Yes, there was, Justice Ridgely, but it was late. The order was in place. The answer was the amended complaint was not supposed to be filed until that was paid. It was filed before that was paid. We gave, and this is in the record, we gave several extensions, tried to work with counsel for the plaintiffs at that point, and eventually it was paid on the day we finally had to write a letter to the court to get something paid. That was the day that the $5,000 was paid. The court below also engaged in a very carefully balancing of interests, and it determined, after considering all of this, that the interests of justice here were best served by dismissal. We respectfully submit that the careful analysis of the court, the record below, and the court's consideration of all the pertinent factors showed that the court did not abuse its discretion in entering dismissal. Mr. Wilkes says this is a one-of-a-kind case and that nothing like this has ever been done before in Delaware. I submit this is a one-of-a-kind case. I hope there is never another case like this in Delaware, and I don't believe there's been one in the Court of Chancery that I'm aware of before. Very unusual facts, but as I've said, the trustee inherited what the trustee inherited and had an obligation to move more quickly than the trustee did. The trustee only acted after we filed a motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute. Mr. Wilkes was not even retained until after we filed that motion to dismiss for failure to prosecute. A point I neglected to mention is that in considering the relevance of all the prior delay, it is important to keep in mind that the Gaylords are not out of this, as the court below stated. Their counsel represents the trustee. The trustee hired their counsel to do the initial investigation. In the court below, I believe in the motion for re-argument, it was stated that part of the delay was due to Mr. Wilkes moving firms. So, and he was previously at the same firm as counsel to the Gaylords prior to the bankruptcy. So the Gaylords aren't out of this. They have a substantial recovery here. And they had a right under the bankruptcy order that if the trustee did not prosecute this, that they could prosecute this. But they weren't here either.
Well, they would inherit the same history that the trustee inherited under your theory, wouldn't they?
Yes. Well, the Gaylords were the persons who caused the history. They were the original plaintiffs. And they did not attempt during the bankruptcy to seek a lifting of the stay to prosecute this claim. Instead, they negotiated a settlement that ensured that this litigation would vest in the trustee after the bankruptcy. It essentially ensured that this case would not move forward until after the bankruptcy. They clearly knew about all the prior delay. They had caused it. And I submit, especially since they had the same counsel, that there was certainly some onus on them as well to push the trustee to move things over long further. They knew full well how quickly the Court of Chancery wanted things to move.
I think I misinterpreted what you meant by the Gaylords are not out of this. I think I now understand what you meant by that.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Your Honor, if I misinterpreted the question. Mr. Wilkes referred to the Hobson's choice of a trustee, that either the trustee needs to commence a prosecution right away without investigation and thereby breaching its fiduciary duties, or investigate and risk dismissal. That's just not the case. What the trustee should have done here, and I submit what a trustee who was diligently carrying out its duties would have done here, is when it commenced the investigation, file the status report that's due. Or at the very least, send a courtesy letter to the court saying, I'm new, I'm investigating this, it's going to take me several months. If the court or the defendants felt that that several-month period, whatever it may be, was too long, it would have been easy to have a scheduling conference and put a schedule in place to move forward. That was never done. There's no Hobson's choice.
Was there any scheduling order entered at any time?
There was a scheduling order entered, and it was ignored. By the time new counsel came in, the fact discovery cutoff had passed, and the new counsel, this is the counsel that came in at the beginning of 2003, moved for extension of time frames and for new discovery periods. And we very reluctantly were accommodating and agreed. There were letters to the court.
Was a new order entered after that?
Your Honor, I am not sure, but I believe a new order was put in place, but I'm not entirely sure that a new order was put in place. But we certainly, in responding to that, informed the court of our great reluctance and our concerns that the delays had already caused prejudice. And that was all in the record. There were certainly new discovery deadlines put in place for long-pending discovery, and those were not complied with, forced us to file a motion to compel. And that motion to compel was withdrawn when the plaintiffs finally agreed, I think, to produce the discovery responses by the next day. They were not very substantive, and we were preparing, as reflected in the correspondence, to file yet another motion to compel when the bankruptcy was filed. Another factor here, raised for the very first time in the reply brief by plaintiffs, is the issue of prejudice. Prejudice was central to our argument below. It was central to the court's findings, but it was nowhere disputed in the answering brief below by the plaintiff, and nor did plaintiffs dispute the existence of prejudice in the motion for re-argument. In their opening brief, in this court, the plaintiffs did not discuss prejudice, even though it's clearly an element. In fact, when they cited the elements at page 17 of their brief, they cited only two of them. Prejudice was not mentioned. We see for the very first time in the reply brief a dispute as to whether prejudice exists here. I submit that under very well-settled precedent, they waived the right to dispute prejudice in the trial court, and they waived the right to dispute the prejudice here in this court as well. Unless Your Honors have any further questions, I would simply like to respectfully request that the court below's decision to dismiss this action with prejudice for failure to prosecute be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Pittman.
Thank you.
That procedure?
Yes.
I have just a few moments. And I would like to put those to good use. First of all, I'm glad Mr. Pittenger brought up this notion of the requirement of status reports in the Court of Chancery. The court's order on that is very instructive here. And I'd like to preface it with the background of Your Honor's decision just less than 2 months ago in the Lehman Capital case, in which the court reversed the dismissal of a case, not on Rule 41 grounds, a little bit different. But the notion that when you dismiss a case with prejudice, you can't do it. The trial court shouldn't do it without warning. There has to be some kind of warning in advance to give the plaintiff some chance to rehabilitate his position before incurring the ultimate sanction. The order that Mr. Pittenger refers to, asking the parties to submit status reports, has I think it's the last sentence of the order says, if the parties fail to, or if the plaintiff fails to submit a status report, this case may be dismissed without prejudice. That's what the status report requirement order said. True, there were status reports filed by both sides for a period of time. The plaintiff's side, who actually at that point, the counsel of record had no client at that point, had no client with authority to proceed with the case. So it's just a law firm without really a client in the case, sent in a few status reports, stopped doing so. Clearly, the record is clear on that. But the sanction that the court said would be imposed in the absence of the provision of status reports was the possibility of dismissal without prejudice. Appellees now come before the court suggesting that dismissal with prejudice, without any warning whatsoever, was wholly appropriate because of the failure to submit status reports. Now, I think that's pretty tough. And I think that's really inconsistent with any notion of fair play and the notion that the court put out just on August 25th, I think, in the Lehman Capital case. We don't dismiss cases with prejudice without any warning whatsoever. And that's what happened here. We have a creditor trustee whose office was created in October of 2005. He had the obligation to handle all the assets in the liquidation of Ingersoll International, the defense of 1,200 claims, some of which were multi-million dollars in value, the prosecution of this case, the prosecution of some other cases. But before he could prosecute this case, before he could retain counsel and start spending money on this case, he had to determine on a good faith basis in the discharge of his fiduciary obligation whether or not it was a useful exercise. It took him 6 months to do that. It took him another month to find counsel, negotiate an engagement letter with us, and on the eve, Your Honor, on the eve of our retention, the motion to dismiss for want of prosecution was filed. That is not the sort of lack of diligence that this court dismisses cases for or countenances the dismissal of cases for. I mean, the Ayers case had 9 years of inactivity, 9 years of inactivity. This court found that case should not have been dismissed for want of prosecution. The CENCOM case was a 10-year-old case, had 5 years of inactivity. The Draper case had well over a year of inactivity. It was allowed to proceed to trial. The Lane case, 10 years of inactivity. And Your Honor, Chief Justice Steele, you found that case should proceed to trial. It's tough to let an old case like that proceed, but that's what happens in this jurisdiction. That's what should happen. The ultimate sanction should not be visited upon a plaintiff for 7 months of inactivity on the docket, where there has been a history that the plaintiff, who may once have been dilatory, showed initiative to take the case forward. Right. I'm running out of my time. I'm over time. I appreciate Your Honor's time. We simply ask the court not to make new law. Follow new law. Follow the old law. Allow the case to go to trial on its merits. Thank you very much.
We'll take the case under advisement and adjourn.